Welcome underground. In this episode, we look at the phantom time hypothesis, the idea that the historical timeline has a few more centuries in it than actually existed. We review the arguments of A.T. Fomenko, the Russian mathematician who is the most visible proponent of this theory, and end up reflecting on the general value of conspiracy theories in helping us occasionally examine the foundations upon which our knowledge system is based. Enjoy.
Okay. The knobs are all aligned. Give us your 3 minutes then on the phantom time hypothesis that I've been promised.
Well, actually, so the phantom time hypothesis is a very limited version of the broader theory. So phantom time hypothesis is the conspiracy theory that 281 years were added to the chronology in the lead up to. There was some event, the coronation of some king or something like that, that they wanted to be in the year 1000. But it was only the year like 770 or something. And so he said, actually, no, next year is the year 1000.
According to my cursory internet sort of preparation for this, according to the phantom time hypothesis, it's the years 614 to 911 AD never happened. They were allegedly fabricated by Pope Sylvester II and the Holy Roman Emperor Otto III to give their reigns religious significance.
Sounds like the sort of thing I'd do.
Mm.
So yeah, we're not talking about that.
Oh, okay, we're not talking about that.
No, we're talking about the much broader and more exciting theory that is more ambitious, because it's more like 1,000 years.
Is this the Fomenko one?
Yeah.
Right, gotcha.
So I have here his book.
Okay.
It's by Anatoly T. Fomenko, called History, Fiction or Science, number one of his The New Chronology series, which runs to about 12 volumes, and I understand that there are diminishing returns from reading anything beyond about chapter 4 of the first volume, which is what I've done. So I came across this book at uni, and it just seemed so out there in what it was trying to argue that I thought I had to read it.
Yeah, well, I agree. I the reason I like this theory is not necessarily because I think it's correct, but because I think it's a really good way of readjusting the way that you look at some things, because of just how far out there it goes. Cards on the table. That's where I'm going to be coming from probably with this. But so for the benefit of the listener, so we're not doing the phantom time hypothesis, which would be the 300 years missing in the Dark Ages. Then the one that you will get if you do a cursory Google about this. We're doing something much more hardcore.
Yeah, it's more like 1,000 years missing. So, okay, I'll tell you the version I got in my head, which, as we've discussed before, is more like what Werner Herzog calls the ecstatic truth. I haven't read any of these books for a long time. There's another good one called The Lost Millennium by Florin Diaku, which is more of a cliff note sort of the state of the art without you having to go deep into Russian nationalistic writings and esoterica.
Okay.
And Alexander Dugin. So you have this guy, Anatoly T. Fomenko, who is a professor of mathematics at Moscow State University. For context, in Russia, mathematicians are seen as the absolute apex of intellectual pursuits, and they're well aware of this. And so the assumption is that all other academic pursuits are lesser than maths. And so if you can master maths, it's pretty clear you're going to be able to master anything else as well, especially something like history. I mean, history's a hobby, not a
bit like the
academic discipline. Yeah,
a bit like the status of classics in our society. Yeah. Once you can do that, history is a doddle.
Yeah, yeah. But with classicists, we're at least on the same page. With the mathematician, he's gonna approach things very differently. So this guy, Anatoly Fomenko, was looking at the orbit of the moon, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And come up with the sort of equations to explain its motion around the Earth. And obviously we have our modern observations of where the moon is at any given time. So we can use that. But if you want to build a model of the moon's motion over the long term, you kind of want to know where it was 100 years ago. You want as much data as you possibly can, so that you've got more data to work with to make, see if your model's fitting.
Yep.
And well, how on earth did you do that? How did you work out where the moon was on a given day 500 years ago? Well, he came across the excellent idea of going through the historical record and looking at eclipses. So if you know there's an eclipse on Thursday, the 23rd of February, 1781, you know exactly where the moon was at that moment, because for the eclipse to be seen in England, everything's got to have lined up.
Yep.
And so that's actually a really solid reading. And so if you go back through the entire historical record and note down when all the eclipses are, so solar or lunar, you can build up a pretty good data set of where the moon's been over the last few thousand years. Eclipses are always seen as important events, and so they're always written down in the evening, in quite scanty records.
Yeah,
and so that's quite sensible. So he did that, and discovered that it didn't line up with his equations at all. If the moon is where the historical record suggested the moon was on those dates, there has to be some unknown force affecting the motion of the moon around the Earth. And he says, well, that doesn't work at all. He started kind of looking at the historical record and was like, well, I kind of trust maths. I'm a mathematician. You know, I trust my equations.
Yeah.
What's this history thing? Is it as trustworthy as maths?
Mm.
And so he did some research into, like, how we know that the year 500 was 1,500 years ago.
Mm.
And he found that it's actually a bit less rock solid than you might expect.
Mm.
And certainly, like, how you assemble all the various individual records we have into a sort of
coherent
chronology.
Timeline. Yeah, coherent
yeah.
timeline. Yeah, yeah.
Like, that was done pretty arbitrarily not that long ago.
Mm.
Often by people with agendas.
Mm.
And so it was like, so actually the historical record or that timeline, that master timeline is probably a bit less reliable than my equations.
Okay.
And so he then started doing the reverse. So you say, well, okay, I was going to use history to tell me where the moon was, but actually it might be more interesting to use where the moon was to see when these events. Because, like, you know, if someone says an eclipse, there was an eclipse. The question is, what year is this in the context of?
Well, the question is how many solar cycles ago it was, isn't it? We have to be quite careful here, because I think you can be... This is one of the interesting things that this gets you to think about, which is that the name of a year is arbitrary.
Mm.
And that's just something to have clearly in your mind, I think, when you embark
on this.
Yeah,
it's an important thought for the rest of this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we say 762 AD... We're referring to the date in the timeline that we all know and love.
Mm.
But that might not be 1,300 solar cycles ago.
Mm.
The contention here is that might actually be 400 solar cycles ago. Back to trying to work out historical events from where we know the moon was. I mean, obviously just an isolated eclipse. It's not, you know, there are lots of eclipses.
Yeah.
Who knows which one it's supposed to be? But sometimes you get quite interesting patterns. So in Thucydides' Peloponnesian Wars, there is a rapid three eclipses in a row, I believe.
Yeah, during the Sicilian campaign, if I remember correctly. And the generals take it as very bad news. Or at least one of them does. Yeah. Yeah.
So he's like, yeah, okay, three eclipses in a row. That is quite unusual.
Mm.
That's probably going to be quite clear from the equations if that did happen. And he ran it, and there was a similar pattern that would have hit Crete, you know, three in a row like that. It was just 1,000 years later.
Okay.
And so he went around all those kind of historical interesting eclipses and looked at patterns in his knowledge of the moon based on his equations, which are pretty bomb-proof. And sort of assembled things into a different order. And the main outcome of that is that our timeline has an extra 1,000 years in it that weren't actually expressed in solar cycles. We just spread things out a lot. There's other supporting evidence as well. You get a lot of temples in Egypt and ancient Greece that have a horoscope, so kind of a picture of the stars, mm-hmm. You know, on the ceiling or on a wall. And actually, those are datable. Like, you can say, okay, well, what date does this star chart correspond to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, given the position of all the planets and stuff like that, that is solvable. And that bore out the same story. These things were, you know, the map of stars portrayed in these supposedly ancient horoscopes were from a few hundred years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you got all of that. And then he started to think, okay, well, how did this happen? Like, we have enough story. There is enough history for our current timeline.
Mm.
So how did all these things happen? Do they happen concurrently rather than in a row? And so he is also a statistician. And so he started to do a kind of statistical analysis of the kind of major sequences in the historical record. Mm. So successions of kings, for example. If you kind of strip out all the fluff and focus on the crunch of a dynasty of kings, you'll say, okay, King One reigned for 30 years, died peacefully in his sleep. His first son took over, reigned badly
mm-hmm.
for 5 years and was murdered.
Mm.
There was then a brief civil war, and then his nephew took over, and he was king for 2 years, died of an accident. Then his son took over, 40-year peaceful reign. And so you can kind of condense something like the Byzantine emperors into that kind of sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can see if that sequence happened anywhere else. And he said that actually, if you take the Byzantine emperors and layered on top of the Old Testament kings, for example, you notice that the patterns are very similar. And so what Fomenko argues is that this shows that it's actually the same story that's just being retold by different people in different contexts, and then, you know, the story's been copied down and changed over time. And so you end up with what looks like two completely different stories when it's actually the same events they're referring to. And so that's how we've kind of filled out this extra timeline that didn't really exist in terms of solar cycles. Should pause there for questions?
Yeah, okay. Questions.
I mean, how does it sound to you first? You know, we've got a rigorous scientific backing plus a plausible humanities explanation of how this happened.
Okay. I suppose that the initial questions that I was thinking of when I was listening to it were, okay, well, I can't see these equations that he's using.
Mm.
And I have no way of assessing their merit or otherwise. Are you aware of what other mathematicians have made of these equations and what they think of them?
No.
Mm.
I'm sure they're fine. He's a professor of maths at Moscow State University.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I suppose that
he's I think this is based on someone else's work as well, who was not Russian.
Okay. Well, okay, so what do I think about this? I think that the idea that the timeline is not a sort of objective fact, but instead an interpretation of facts that has been put together over a long period of time using fragmentary evidence is a very healthy thing to have presented to you starkly, because we tend to think of it as this kind of objective fact that the events happened in the order that they happened, and they happened in the year that they happened, and that, you know, a year, the essence of a year is the number that we assign it. And that because that year is assigned that number, it happened a certain number of years ago. And I think that, you know, the idea that we have assigned certain events to certain dates doesn't make it a certainty that they did happen in that year. We tend to think of it as a certainty because it's so widely accepted and it's so intrinsic to the study of history that these dates, you know, the dates of events have taken on the sort of mantle of objective truth. And I think that it's a very, very good thing to be shocked into reappraising the idea that actually all that's really going on here is that the Earth is traveling around the sun, and we use this sort of astronomical clock as the basis for orienting ourselves in time in relation to history, and that we give it a sort of a digital value, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, starting from some arbitrary point. And that everything is sort of arbitrarily arranged according to that arbitrary starting point and how long ago, how many solar cycles ago we think it is. And then everything else is arranged in a kind of a line according to that digital numbering system. And, you know, that's not been done as history happens. It's not like people in what we think of as, you know, 14 AD, where the, you know, the succession of Tiberius to the throne of to the Principate. It's not like they are thinking we're in 14 AD, you know, and they're not writing down, you know, on their documents, 14, you know, 23rd of February, 14 AD. You know, it's everybody's using their own different timelines. You know, the Romans dated it from what they thought of as the foundation of the city, which
ab urbe, you know, condita,
exactly. Which, you know, in Tiberius's time was roughly 750 years ago, or solar cycles ago. So I think it's very, very good to have that refreshing mental little ice bath where actually, you know, did X event happen in the year 982? Well, maybe, but maybe it was 983 and maybe it was 981. And what are we actually talking about there? We're not really talking about the number. We're talking about the number of journeys around the sun ago that it happened. And so is that reorientation, I think, is a healthy one.
So you're not yet engaging in the substance.
I also think that the possibility that there are errors in our timeline is a very, very high probability. In fact, I'd say it's nearing 100% probability that there are errors. Because there's, you know, there's a lot of history and there's a lot of events, and our sources are very, very fragmentary once you get back beyond a couple of hundred years. And the idea that, you know, everything happened in the way that we think it did is very, very unlikely. Yeah. However,
so just to build on that, so my tutor used to call any history after 1600 journalism, because
you mean before?
It's only history of before about 1600 AD, because that's when you have no idea what's going on, so you can just make it up.
Yeah.
It was after then, you just kind of read what happened, because it's all pretty thoroughly written.
Yeah, so, I think that
Yeah, but before about Henry VIII, it gets a lot shadowier.
Yeah. For sure,
but anyway,
for sure.
I keep interrupting you.
No, that's okay. But the idea that there is a big chunk that has been... Okay, so first of all, thoughts on the idea that there's a conspiracy theory, right?
I haven't mentioned a conspiracy theory.
I know you haven't, but...
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah, you haven't mentioned the conspiracy theory. And it's a humdinger, listener, for when it comes. It involves a Russian horde. Any listener who's thinking, oh, well, what's the conspiracy that underlies this? And, you know, there is a conspiracy theory about the more limited phantom time hypothesis about the Dark Ages, as we mentioned at the top of the show.
Yeah, and there's a great one.
I think that is extremely unlikely.
Okay, I should probably say what it is first. Yeah.
Okay. What I'll say is I think it's extremely unlikely because of the number of... I know what you're going to say about the number of people that need to be in on it. I know exactly what you're going to say with the monks and the monasteries and only a few hundred people.
I'm just worried that you're priming our audience to take against what I'm about to say.
I am much more sympathetic to the idea that any errors that might be there are the result of just errors, human errors. You know, I'm very sympathetic to that idea. But I don't think that there... I think it's very unlikely that there is an overarching conspiracy or a significant amount of time that's somehow phantom in European history. And I also think that we have to... The immediate thing that everybody who hears this, who's sceptical, goes to is that they say, well, this is very Eurocentric, dare I say it. And what about, you know, the Chinese astronomical records? What about, you know, other stuff from other places in the world, you know, and all of this kind of thing? And then you can very easily start to get into the weeds of radiocarbon dating, tree rings, you know, what does a sign in the heavens actually look like and all of that kind of thing. And it's unbelievably complex. And I think that the danger that you are selecting the evidence you want to select and interpreting it in the way that you want to interpret it is very high.
You fired out your repudiations of various elements of the theory before they've been mentioned.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, you can just edit it. You can just edit it. You can cut that out and then put it in.
That's dishonorable.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So the conspiracy theory, as given by Anatoly Tifomenko, a proud Russian and follower of the Eurasian school of thought, that Russia's place is as the kind of the big Eurasian power that's in opposition to the us Atlanticists on the coast, and it's fundamentally a very different sort of power because it's very continental. Everyone in Europe and America,
is this the Dugin thing?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is very influential currently in Russian leadership circles, and in many ways you can see them working off Dugin's playbook. Oh, what was that book you wrote? I forget. Something about geopolitics.
I know the one you mean. I can't remember the title.
Yeah.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. But it's basically exactly what Putin's doing now.
Yeah.
It's from the same kind of intellectual area as this one. And he says that there are two reasons why this could have happened. And as I've explained it so far, it could just be errors and retellings over time and no one really worrying about the timeline until more recently. And then people are trying to assemble it from fragments and getting it wrong.
Yeah.
And as you say, that is a much stronger theory. Sadly, after volume one of History, Fiction, and Science, he goes down another route, which is to say, actually, in about the 1600s, this was all done deliberately to cover up the fact that Europe was dominated by the Russians before then. And that, you know, Venice was having to send an annual tribute to Moscow.
And he sort of means, when he's talking about the Russians there, he's talking about Central Eurasian peoples, isn't he?
The Eurasians. He thinks
of the Eurasians as one sort of, I guess, heterogeneous sort of horde. Slavic sort of
maybe, although
conglomeration.
I could be Mongolian.
Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan are the same character, doesn't he? He thinks they're the same person retold.
I get that.
Yeah, I mean, we've all got
they are quite similar.
That way. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that he does think of them as... It's the Eurasians, you're right. Eurasians, however he's
got. Yeah. But you've got to also bear in mind that high in the Russian psyche is this idea of Mongol hordes, because every few hundred years a Mongol horde comes and just absolutely smashes up Russia. It doesn't get as far as Western Europe, so we don't really feel it viscerally. You had Genghis Khan, you had the Golden Horde, and so it's not a massive leap if you grew up with that kind of thing embedded in your mind, that there could be a similar horde that actually did take all of Europe. And then, obviously, those kind of large empires, it's not like, you know, they actually rule your day-to-day life, but they do demand tribute, you know.
Okay,
yeah. And so that's the kind of setup. Yeah.
He thinks that Western Europe was dominated by a Eurasian-Russian horde.
Yeah.
But that it was sort of a tributary arrangement.
Rather
than a direct governance kind of arrangement. Is that right?
And then when we finally threw off the Eurasian yoke in the 1600s, there was a big conspiracy led by the Vatican to kind of get that out of the historical record. And so they kind of pulled up the gaps with retold stories that are already there and added the extra years. Slightly plausible because any historical document we have from before like 1600 is probably a copy.
Yeah.
We just have to trust it's a good copy. Yep. Like, it's quite rare to get like the original document from 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. Although we do have some.
Oh yeah. But a lot of it's a lot more, it would be accounting records or legal records or things like that. It won't be a narrative.
Yeah, I think that's broadly right. I'd have to review what's in the Oxyrhynchus papyri. I mean, when you look at Oxyrhynchus,
is in the desert in Egypt. Like that doesn't have much bearing on Western European history. There are some documents, but
well, it's written in Greek by Greeks, most of it. The Oxyrhynchus stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, saying that it's got no bearing on Western history, I think.
Okay.
Not quite right.
But like, it's orthogonal enough to be able to gloss over it.
Okay. If you like.
Shut up.
can't just use the word orthogonal. Like a sort of ink bomb.
That's what my old boss did in times of stress, yeah.
Right. Anyway, yeah, okay, go on. But yeah, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, and I'm not actually an expert on this, there's been no sort of significant sort of finds of poetry and so forth from the Oxyrhynchus papyri.
Although I am stoked about what they're doing with, have you read about the
Herculaneum
project?
Stuff. Yeah. Very, very exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very exciting. I mean, you know.
This is a project to use AI and stuff to scan these metal scrolls that we got from Herculaneum.
Yeah. I don't think they're even metal. I think they're leather or papyrus. And they just return to charcoal in the heat. So they were sort of, you have to imagine a storeroom being covered in a sort of pyroclastic flow, but then baked essentially, because it doesn't necessarily collapse, but obviously the temperature in there rises to some sort of an insane thing. And so all of the material sort of turns to charcoal. And then it's using this kind of X-rays basically to go through the charcoal and then using AI to just pick up on the most minute sort of little variations in the returns that they get to see where the ink was, and then the AI kind of piecing that all together. I mean, it's an amazing stuff. And they are starting to read the first ones now, and I think that the first one that they've looked at, they're thinking is a philosophical work, but it's so at the moment it's still just quite tantalizing. So we'll see how it comes. Yeah. Mm.
It might prove Fomenko right, you know.
It might. Anyway, yeah, go on. Yeah. So we don't from before 1600. We don't have. We tend not to have original documents.
Yeah.
We
certainly don't. You can have, see how.
Yeah.
A conspiracy could take place.
Yeah, I mean.
Or at the very least, how errors could creep in, because they're copied documents and copied by monks in a hurry.
I mean, do you want to sort of a bit of an argument now about that particular point, or do you want to kind of keep going?
Hit me.
Well, I think that the idea establishing that there's an opportunity for a mass invention or a mass forgery is a bit of a red herring, because of course at the time they're not aware that the documents that they're copying from are not going to survive. So the idea that in the 1600s, everybody's thinking, well, you know, this is year zero, and we know it is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So you're not making a replacement, you're making a copy for a different library. You're promulgating the text rather than making them more, live longer.
I suppose what I'm saying is that there are two interpretations of the fact that we don't really have original manuscripts from before 1600.
Mm.
There's the interpretation that it's because paper degrades, or, you know, papyrus or parchment, as it would be. Or there's the interpretation that there's because there's this big conspiracy.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be a sort of soggy Sally, but, you know.
Well, so you're saying what's not possible is in the middle, where it doesn't need to be a conspiracy because everyone knew the paper would degrade. That's ridiculous. Like, it's either the paper degraded or there's a conspiracy. It's not there were errors and stuff that crept in because they wouldn't have thought in terms of the originals degrading over time.
I suppose what I'm saying is that it's perfectly reasonable to think that errors crept in over time, but that's not the same thing as a conspiracy, because it's all being copied out by hand. Yeah. And, you know, it's being done by individuals, and individuals are strange things, and they make mistakes, or they make little additions, or they, you know, they do all kinds of
tell
funny
the ecstatic
things.
Truth.
Yeah. So that's perfectly fine. But I, you know, so there's two different explanations there for why, for, you know, that perfectly comfortably tell a story about why we don't have stuff from before then. And it's to do with changes in the technology, the degradation of the original materials, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And that explains both the lack of the original documents and the kind of the inconsistencies between the copies perfectly well, without needing to invoke a sort of a conspiracy.
Yeah, so it's consistent with a conspiracy. However, there are other mechanisms by which it could have happened.
Yes, which seem to have a slightly more comfortable explanatory force, because there's the sort of the Occam's razor thing, and there's... You know, there's the fact that we know it's true anyway that the documents would have degraded, and it's true anyway that people copying them out by hand would have made errors. So you don't need a third element of a conspiracy to have. There's no explanatory gap to close.
Yeah, on that specific.
On that specific point. Yeah.
So it doesn't rule out a conspiracy, but
it doesn't rule it out. No, it doesn't rule it out, but it also doesn't make it a particularly strong piece of evidence for the conspiracy. Yeah, but I know that's very boring. So I get it. Like, this idea is an exciting idea that there's sort of phantom that all of history is sort of wrong, and it's just because we're so habituated to authority, isn't it? You know, authority tells us that there's this timeline. We're given this in school based on authority. And, you know, the thrill of a kind of a revisionist anti-authoritarian kind of, no, it's all wrong, you know, and it's very exciting. I get
especially
that.
When it also seems a bit like common sense. Like it's ridiculous that the Roman era and the Renaissance are separated by 1,000 years of desolation. Like, it'd be much, much more straightforward in my mind if they carried straight on and you didn't have the Dark Ages in between.
Yeah, I get that as well. I get that as well. And I think that, you know, explaining the Dark Ages is one of the really difficult things that is sort of historians, is one of the really difficult tasks that historians have in front of them. And
we have done. I mean, have we discussed this on this podcast before? Like you know, that gap between Mycenaean Greeks and classical Greeks or the interdynastic periods in Egyptian history or the rise and fall of the various empires in Central America. You can see countless examples across the world of development not being linear. Things don't always get better. Sometimes everything just falls apart for a couple hundred years.
Yeah, I think we have briefly talked about it earlier on in some of the early podcasts, the idea that actually, and that whether you are in inverted commas sort of declining or ascending as a civilization is completely changes presumably your view of what reality is. It changes your perception of the direction of time in a sense. If you think of time as we think of time as the direction in which power and wealth increases more or less. But if you're living in a declining civilization, a period of decline, then you think of the direction of time as the opposite, is the direction in which power and wealth decreases.
Exactly. If you're a subsistence farmer in the shadows of the pyramids, or if you're a wound covered British warrior in the shadow of all the big Roman Roman buildings that are falling to ruin, you don't know how they're built. Have you ever read that poem?
Yes, I have. Yeah, you sent it to me. Yeah, the one about the what parties they would have had. So I mean, and the idea of you know thinking about the timeline and understanding that the timeline is something that was constructed by Europeans relatively recently, and that the people who are living through that timeline. You know, the Alexander the Greats, the Egyptian pharaohs, the sort of, you know, the Chinese emperors and stuff, they're actually living in different timelines. They're living in their own timelines, which are completely different from our timeline. And, you know, we are very comfortable with the idea that, well, Alexander the Great sits in this relationship to Cleopatra, And, you know, Cleopatra sits in this relationship to Ramesses the Great, and he sits in this relationship to the Chinese emperor over there. Can you tell I don't know many dynastic names of the Chinese?
Right, Ramesses is to my shame. Safe bet. Yeah.
Yeah. you know, we're very happy in thinking in those terms, as if it's a kind of an objective truth about the world, like it's a fact in the same way that the sun rising is a fact. But actually, you know, it's something that we've constructed, and that all the subjects who are peopling this timeline would have had a completely different understanding of their relationship to absolutely everything that we're talking about.
But also, I mean, there's another question, like, well, what's the point of reconstructing a timeline? Like, well, when does that become interesting?
I suppose it's part of that great enlightenment project of cutting everything up and putting it in its proper place. It's the classificatory impulse, isn't it? Like, and you see it in, you know, people like Linnaeus, you know, classifying the sort of flora and fauna of the planet.
Yeah.
I think we were doing the same to history and to time.
I think it was Cassini. But actually, there was a way before then. So you had a whole load of kind of Roman historians who are now called saints, who were trying to unite the Old Testament timeline with the Roman timeline. And so a lot of intellectual effort went into that, Orosius and Boethius and Augustine, actually. Augustine was trying to do this when Rome fell. So part of the reason why you try and unite these two timelines, or at least see where they fit in with each other, is so you can tell a kind of narrative of all of human history that ends with the climax of Rome being Christianized, and then, like, you know, I think the whole world is a choir praising God was what either Orosius or Boethius said. And then just as Augustine was trying to write this, Rome got sacked by Goths or Huns or something, and it's like, oh, okay, it's a bit of a challenge with my narrative here. And that's why he wrote City of God, because then he had to try and explain why that was okay, that Christian Rome had been sacked. And that, you know, it's no longer linear development. So that's how we had to kind of separate the ideas.
Yeah, and I suppose that, you know, you're getting towards the idea there that the timeline that each civilization constructs, it does so to suit its purposes. It just so happens that our purposes are empirical, so we are making universalizing claims to objective truth when we do it.
So is Bede. So there's a lot of debate in the 7th century about when Easter should be, the date of Easter. And the only way you can do that is by trying to work out how many years have passed between me today and Jesus dying. It's a movable feast. And so actually, people were trying to get an empirical answer then as well for quite neutral reasons. But now I guess there's nothing really at stake when we're trying to assemble a timeline. It's just
I think what is at stake, and this I think links nicely to the likes of Dugin. What is at stake is, in a sense, the Western intellectual supremacy in the world. And what I mean by that is I don't mean the West is cleverer than anyone else. What I mean is that Western ideas, the Western way of seeing the world, has come to dominate the world through the period of European dominance and latterly American dominance. And I think that the timeline is such a fundamental part of that. It goes right to the heart of the Enlightenment project of creating an objective view of and classifying and putting everything in its right place according to the standards of empiricism and materialism and science and all of that kind of thing. And so when the likes of Dugin are attacking the timeline, it's just another way of trying to attack, you know, the hegemony of the West in the realm of, you know, in intellectual things. And I think that makes perfect sense. It's an attack on authority, you know, the authority.
It's kind of one of the mind games they play, like by funding the Green Party in Germany to, you know, campaign against nuclear power to make them all their funding and effort that goes into trying to just destabilize the West a bit. Yeah, actually, I mean, what could be more destabilizing?
What could be more destabilizing than the idea that actually there's phantom time and, you know, all of this kind of thing?
Just having the rug pulled straight from under your understanding of where we sit in relation
just
to everything.
Everything. Yeah, yeah. I think that that is the best way to understand it. I don't think it's at all an insignificant thing that Fomenko is writing all of this. And isn't it in the 90s, in the early noughties, when Russia is going through this period of absolute turmoil, of, you know, humiliation by the Western powers and all of this kind of thing? I think it's a way of hitting back, whether conscious or not. And I think that it's perfect. It's you can see Putin and the way that he operates perfectly springing from this kind of thing. It's about casting doubt, undermining, sowing uncertainty, trying to divide, you know, blah, 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 blah. And of course, it's very unsexy to just defend the status quo. Like, be like, oh, actually, I think...
As you always find yourself doing it.
Actually, I think, you know, my teacher at school was right, actually. I don't think this kind of exciting theory is right. I think it's not quite right. You know, that's not very glamorous and, you know, it's not very cool and it's not very... it's not even particularly rewarding, you know.
Yeah, what have you achieved by defending the score? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that is what's going on. But that said, as I said, I think it is a good thing to be challenged, because it makes you, you know, you can always, from any challenge, you can look and think, right, well, what am I complacent about, or what have I, you know, slipped into thinking of in terms of objective fact, when actually it's interpretation and blah, blah, blah. So you can, you know, it keeps you on your toes, which I think is a really good thing in its own way.
And certainly I think a healthy skepticism of scientists is something that we should probably develop as a culture. But one of the obvious objections to the phantom time hypothesis is radiocarbon dating. It's like, no, I mean, we know that this object is from 1,200 years ago, which fits with the normal timeline.
I remember reading about this, but the idea that radiocarbon dating, I think, to a certain extent, is calibrated using dendrochronology.
Yeah.
And obviously, the problem with that is that our definition of the reading on the carbon dating that is defined as 1,200 years ago can, in some circumstances, be a result of assumptions that are already baked into your count back on the dendrochronology.
Can you quickly explain what dendrochronology is?
Sorry, yeah. So dendrochronology is literally counting tree rings.
Yeah.
And every year you get a ring in a tree trunk. Because of the cycles of growth through the seasons, it forms a ring. And, you know, in a good year, the ring will be a nice thick ring. And sort of a lean year, it'll be a thin one. And this gives patterns. So you can see across many different trees, the pattern of thick and thin years is the same. And you can then start to build up quite an elaborate database that puts all these patterns together.
You can see that, a sequence of, you know, two amazing years, three terrible years, one amazing year, one terrible year. You can see that in the kind of inner rings of a younger or more recent tree, and you can also see it in the outer rings of a much older tree.
Yes.
And so you can kind of chain the records of individual trees together by matching up the patterns, and people claim that we've now got actually a record going back about 12,000 years.
Of these overlapping
tree rings. Yeah.
Exactly. And then some things are made of wood. So you can sort of, if you're very careful, look at the tree rings.
Yeah, exactly.
Boats. So that tree was cut down in this year, because we can tell, because the ring of trees fits in here in the pattern. Yeah. And if this was cut down in this year, you know, we think that was, you know, 800 years ago.
And that tree becomes part of the chain. And then you can then use that one to compare other. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, the thing is, though, that I think that it's very easy kind of from your armchair to say, your radiocarbon dating is partly contingent on your understanding of dendrochronology. And the problem with that is that you're just baking in assumptions and it's all circular. It's very easy to kind of say that from your armchair. But when you actually think about it in practice, we're talking about, you know, millions of data points across the whole world. You know, it's not actually the kind of shaky house of cards that it might intellectually...
Yeah, although at the same time, it is quite jarring. You hear radiocarbon dating, you think, okay, scientific, that sounds bomb-proof. Not going to think about that. And then you suddenly realize it's calibrated based on counting tree rings.
Yeah, and, I mean, I don't know like, whether okay, it's that, purely, that, 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 I don't know whether it's purely calibrated on that, but you know, I'm going off something I've read.
I think that is the main thing we got.
Yeah.
And then Radiocarbon Dating, you know, is looking at the carbon isotopes. Well, you can have these kind of solar events and things like that that have, you know, greatly changed the concentration of carbon 16 versus carbon 14 in any location. Like there are explanations consistent with there being discontinuities, which is why you have to calibrate. So I think it's more, as with the COVID scientists, just turning that 100%, yeah, this got to be true, it's science, to just like 90%. A lot of people work very hard on it, the best we can do for the time being, but it's not certain.
Yeah, I think that my calibration would be a little bit higher than yours, but roughly I'm in agreement with you. Yeah, maybe mine would be 95 or 97 and a half. But I think, I take your fundamental point, absolutely, and you know that I agree with you about that actually, just because someone's an expert in quotation marks, I mean, and so just because somebody's a scientist, it doesn't mean that they are gospel. It's not revealed truth. You do have to still be skeptical about it.
And as we're talking on panspermia about what's difficult about that subject, is you need to be an expert both on astronomy and biology. Mm. To really understand radiocarbon dating, you've got to be an expert on particle physics and also on whatever historical thing you're looking at. Archaeology, yeah. And actually, yeah. Is anyone mastery clued up on both those things to the same level? No,
it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, but there will be people who have clued themselves up for particular problems and particular theses.
Exactly. I assume a lot of work's gone into this, and it's
yeah. I just think that while there are sort of little get-out back doors out of the kind of the iron sort of or the smothering pillow of all of this kind of evidence of. Radiocarbon dating and tree rings and all of that kind of thing. There are little sort of escape routes that you can try and wriggle out of. Each escape route involves a much greater call upon your credulity than the alternative explanation, which is just that the consensus is right.
Yeah, exactly. for this theory to be true, a whole load of kind of 2% assumptions have to line up.
Yeah,
and so for me, it's not so much that I believe it. I like playing with the idea, but it's that. It's just nice to have the back of their mind that I mean, our timeline might all be, made up. Like it just that little bit of doubt. I think
it's almost a certainty that the timeline is wrong in places.
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah.
But I think that those places are probably quite minor and obscure and recondite. And I think the broad outline is probably is, you know, according to the understanding of the world that we currently have is broadly, and actually in most of its detail correct. There are some interesting things that I remember you telling me about the pharaohs. A lot of them have the same names. Mm. And so you dig up a stone and you say, Pharaoh, Tutankhamun. Ah, yes, that's that date. When actually there are five, it's over a period of 1,000 years and you might have the wrong one. And that throws your whole sort of, fourth dynasty out of whack. I think that's very plausible. But we're talking about something that's pretty obscure there.
Well, and then you've got like contamination of archaeological sites. Like it's quite common for stuff to get mixed up.
Yeah. But I think that the most interesting bit of these theories is that is why they are appealing and why people formulate them and it's a difficult line to tread, isn't it? Because on the one hand, I don't want to go down the route of just saying, oh, this is against the consensus, therefore it's laughable and wrong. I think that you do have to, you should always take these things seriously. I read a couple of articles online before doing the podcast about, phantom time and flamenco and all of that kind of thing. And a lot of them just say, well, this is obviously pseudoscience, ha ha ha, and laughable. And then they don't actually engage with it at all.
Yeah.
They just say it is and leave it at that. And you think, well... the problem with that is that it does make it sound as if you're just trying to laugh it off and that you're not actually able to grapple with it.
Yeah, you haven't actually engaged with it and thought about it.
Yeah. And I know that I haven't really, you know, it's not like I've taken apart his equations or looked at it. I said, well, he's forgot to carry the one, hasn't he? You know, and you've done any kind of like technical debunking.
I would like to see someone debunk that moon equation. Because like that feels like just a really solid bit of evidence that's easily disproven.
There is something on Wikipedia about sort of getting the value D slightly misaligned or something like that. But again, I'm not equipped to understand whether that is right or wrong in any significant way at all. But the difficulty is that when you have sort of theories like this, the layman on the street over which we are, you know, we don't have the technical expertise to delve into it at all. We've got to think, right, okay, I've got this weight of authority on this hand and I've got this weight of authority on that hand.
Which one do I trust? Which is my identity most aligned with or something?
Which team am I on? You know? And then it becomes much more about social signifying and virtue signaling and, you know, whatever. But I think that what's interesting is that the approach that I've tried to take, and I think that this is the interesting approach to take when you're kind of weighing up these theories versus the consensus or versus the, you know, the established authority, is thinking, well, what is the underpinning, worldview? What is the underpinning agenda for each one? And both will have an underpinning worldview and both will have an underpinning agenda. If you can kind of compare them, that's much easier to do as the sort of the...
You're absolutely ignoring the kind of objectively testing the claims and instead looking at why they're saying this.
I'd almost say that the specifics of the claims are almost like noise for us and really the signal...
Okay,
is,
yeah, so as a layman... Yeah. We cannot judge the claim on its merits.
No.
Instead, we've got to work out how it's trying to manipulate us.
Yeah, and you think, well, if this is trying to manipulate me that way, and this is trying to manipulate me that way, which way do I think is the one that is bending me closer to my understanding of objective truth?
Mm.
And I suppose that I'm afraid I come down on the side of the...
I mean, I honestly hadn't thought of this theory in terms of being a Russian psyop to demoralize us. That had not occurred to me at all, and it puts an interesting light on the whole thing.
I mean, that's just the flamenco one. I mean, the other one, the Phantom Time one, is actually a German.
I think it's all building on the works of like Frenchmen 100 years ago as well. There was someone who said this theory and then said that, I forget his name, but anyway, a French guy about 100, 150 years ago, wrote this scandalous text saying, monks in the 17th century had fabricated, you know, the history before that. And when I die, my sealed papers will reveal why, you know, what was their motive. Then he died and no one could find the thing saying why or what their motive
was. Priory of Zion and the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. That's that kind of story, isn't it?
It is.
What's the name of the village? I even went there. What's it called?
Not by Carcassonne, is it? But
no, it's the one by. I can't remember. Can't remember the name of the village.
Actually went on a conspiracy tour.
I went to the church.
Yeah,
I went to the church where he found the documents, the abbey, and all of that. Yeah, what's it called?
And by that hill that all the Grail myths talk about.
The Crack de Chevalier is the... That's the
Middle East.
No, that's the Middle East. No,
but it is Crack to something, isn't it?
It's Crack to something, yeah. Anyway.
Been to Crack de Chevalier. It was very nice. It was being used by the Syrian rebels as a fortress for a while. And in many ways this made me sad, but in many ways it made me happy that the castle was still being used for its original intent.
Yeah, I think that's. I don't think that's. I mean, it was used by the locals as a fortified position before the knights got there. It's just it's nice to see it still being used for its intended
purpose.
Better
than just being a museum, isn't it?
I mean, I live on the slopes of an Iron Age hill fort, and I often think about, you know, come the apocalypse. Well, that's where I'm going to fortify. Some nice skylarks up there at the moment, though. I'd be sad to evict them. So is that a concluding... Oh, is there anything that we've missed out from the our discussion of the phantom time hypothesis and flamenco?
I mean, probably, but I think we've conveyed the main thrust. It's quite funny how little there is about it on, like, Wikipedia and stuff.
Mm.
I was expecting quite a long article, and what it is just two sentences explaining what it is and then a whole lot of reasons why it's wrong.
Yeah.
Which makes me suspicious. Again, back to, like, how am I being manipulated? Yeah.
I think that quite often the mistake
is maybe this, trying to cover this up.
this would be my concluding thoughts, because this is quite relevant actually. This is almost a sort of a matters of state episode actually, because it's quite relevant to what you see now, the political dynamic that's playing out with sort of, you know, the Trumpist takeover of the American government, and that's not a pejorative way of phrasing that, by the way. It's just a descriptive way. It is what is happening, and the sort of the difficult position, what's happening in Europe with the AfD and all of the reform in the UK and all of this kind of thing. I think that what unites them is that they are more hostile and sceptical to established narratives. And I think that why is that? How would you characterize them?
Well, exactly that. And why would they think like that? Well, look at what the establishment's kind of been doing for the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of complacency and inertia in people who think that they are on the side of the obvious truth, but they haven't done the thinking. Mm. And so they've drifted. You get the drift away from, I don't know, what corresponds with reality because of that complacency. And it's much healthier for any established interest group that, you know, is the establishment to actually not try and shut down questions or skepticism with sort of, you know, mockery or ad hominem attacks or, you know, all of these things that they've done in a, you might say, quite lazy way. And actually say, well, okay, yeah, let's go, like, intellectually, let's go toe-to-toe, like, bring it on. Yeah. But the problem is that takes confidence and it takes, thought.
Well, and then the other thing is that I think this has showed that, a lot of people haven't really thought about things like this. I mean, again, this whole question, as you say, that not many people think about the timeline as something that might not be real.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have that across every aspect of policy and government...
And the other pitfall is that if you get to a series of established truths and worldviews, then people stop having to think about them because the consensus becomes so overwhelming that they just kind of become accepted facts, and nobody has to do the thinking.
You start building on top of them rather than reinventing the wheel. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you get a couple of generations in and suddenly you've got a generation of people that aren't able to do that. They're not aware of the thinking that goes into them and the sort of the process that's led to them. And so suddenly a challenge comes along and they can only respond with ridicule or whatever. Mm. And the problem then is that it's like, well, hang on a second, is this just the emperor's new clothes? Like, are you actually, you know, you think you're clothed in all of this truth, but are you actually naked? Like, you know, can you prove it? Can you persuade me? Yeah. You know?
And then especially when things start going a bit wrong as well, like when everything's flying, it's like, oh yeah, it's probably true. But then...
Yeah.
As soon as social contract starts breaking down, it's like, well, yeah, hang on.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, Kemi Badenoch, she's the one who's in the most interesting political position right now, in my view, because she's got a choice, and it's such an interesting choice. Does she go the reform route of being the anti-establishment, anti-authority? Does she throw a lot in with that political movement? Or you might broadly put as the sort of the Trumpist or the populist. And again, those are not pejoratives. They're just descriptors. Or does she actually try and make a skeptical, solid, intellectual case for the more mainstream, conservative political tradition? And the thing is that I think it's a really, really interesting choice and such a difficult one because I think that going for the former is the short-term temptation.
But yeah.
And I think it probably aligns a little bit with her own emotional inclinations in a way, because she's been in that position relative to her own party and the Labour Party.
Yeah.
But actually, I think that deep down, she, when you look at what she says her beliefs are, actually aligns more with the more mainstream traditional conservative political ideology. And so having to make that case involves, in a sense, her having to do something that corresponds to her own real political tradition, but that is against her emotional inclination and her previous positioning within her own political context. And of course, that is going to it's much riskier, much harder, because it's not something that people are receptive to right now. So it's like, do you do that as an opposition leader?
You're not going to get the media time, and you're not going to be invited to those like high budget US conferences. But
with them, you know, without wanting to sound too dramatic about it, I think to a certain extent, upon that decision that she makes, you know, the first half of the 21st century for Great Britain depends. Because if she doesn't, if she goes for the reform, that political tradition will, you know, may well be the second force in politics versus the left.
Yeah.
And that will have a massive impact on what happens. But if she goes for the latter, then, you know, they might be able to slay, though, you know, they may well outlive the Farageist dragon. And I think that my personal assessment is they probably would. And, you know, the return to what we might think of as normality might then occur, or modified, of course.
Yeah, continue the proud tradition of the last 20 years of British politics continue building on greatness.
Well, I mean, that's the problem, though, isn't it? Is that does she allow the Farageist critique to modify and improve, you know, to challenge some of the assumptions and to refine and to reinvent the mainstream,
and to go back radio accommodating, it seems fine.
Like, well, we've thought about it from fundamentals, from the ground up, and actually, no, we do like our institutions, and, you know, the rule of law broadly, and, you know, the judges are overreaching a little bit, but fundamentally, we will,
and actually, we can fix that with some tweaks rather than setting it on fire.
Kind of gradualist kind of thing, rather than just breaking it. And, you know, that, I think that is the most fateful political choice that any leader in Britain is currently facing when you think about the future of the country. And I'm very interested to see what it's going to be. Of course, it might be a mischaracterization to think of it as her choice. In a sense, it's a choice of the wider Conservative Party. In a sense, she's just a...
without their backing, then she'll be cut pretty quickly. So
as always, as leader, she's more of a passenger than we realise, I think.
Yeah.
But it's the same of any leader. But so which way the Tory party jumps is a fateful one, in my view. But so do they go for do they throw their lot in with, you know, fundamentally the part of the political spectrum that leads all the way to Dugin and phantom time hypothesis.
Yeah.
Or do they
stick with the status quo?
Do they stick
with big archaeology? You know, the man.
Yeah, the man. Yeah. Yeah. The boring man. Anyway, there's
what I take from that, from the political minutiae is, so I think we talked in a recent episode about how important it is to have a memento mori, that occasional reminder that you're going to die, and you will live better, make better choices if you've got that at the back of your mind. I think also remember that you'll be wrong, or you might be wrong. Yeah, there's a small chance that what you're doing is wrong. Having that in the back of your mind at the same time.
Memento erroris or something, I think.
I'll take it.
To do the Latin,
I'll
just be embarrassing if I got that wrong. But I'm gonna say memento erroris. Yeah.
Memento erroris.
And
for me, I think this lost millennium theory fulfills that for me. Just have it in the back of my mind all the time. Just remember that actually all the foundation stones of what you're believing or doing at the moment, they could just be wrong.
They could be wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. They might not. Yeah, probably aren't, but they might be.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not. They're not objective facts.
Yeah.
They're our best interpretation.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Hopefully that makes a sort of coherent episode. Taking the listener on a bit of a journey there.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting Kimmy Badenoch to come out, but she did.
She did. Yeah. Kimmy, if you're listening, do the right thing.
Whichever it is.
Whichever it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, well, very good. I'll speak to you soon.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Goodbye.